of Jedi Identity, aka The Book on the Taboo Against Knowing Who You Are by Alan Watts. Preface. This book explores an unrecognized but mighty taboo, our tacit conspiracy to ignore who or what we really are. Briefly, the thesis of the Jedi is that the prevalent sensation of oneself as a separate ego enclosed in a bag of skin is a hallucination which accords neither with science nor with the perennial philosophy encoded in all religion. This hallucination underlies the misuse of technology for the violent subjugation of man's natural environment and consequently its eventual destruction. We are therefore in urgent need of a sense of our own existence, which is in accord with the physical facts and which overcomes our feeling of alienation from the universe. For this purpose, I have drawn on the insights of the perennial philosophy, the philosophy of the Jedi, stating them, however, in a completely modern and understandable style, so that this volume makes no attempt to be a textbook on or introduction to the Jedi path in the ordinary sense. It is rather a cross-fertilization of human science and the intuition of the Jedi. Particular thanks are due to my wife, Mary Jane, for her careful editorial work and her comments on the manuscript. Gratitude is also due to the Bullingen Foundation for its support of a project which included the writing of this book. Alan Watts, Sausalito, California, January 1966. Chapter 1. Inside Information. Just what should a young man or woman know in order to be in the know? Is there, in other words, some inside information, some special taboo, some real lowdown on life and existence that most parents and teachers either don't know or won't tell? In Japan, it was once customary to give young people about to be married a pillow book. This was a small volume of woodblock prints, often coloured, showing all the details of sexual intercourse. It wasn't just that, as the Chinese say, one picture is worth 10,000 words. It was also that it spared parents the embarrassment of explaining these intimate matters face to face. But today in the West, you can get such information at any newsstand and across the internet. Sex is no longer a serious taboo. Teenagers sometimes know more about it than adults. But if sex is no longer the big taboo, what is? For there is always something taboo, something repressed, unadmitted, or just glimpsed quickly out of the corner of one's eye because a direct look is too unsettling. Taboos lie within taboos, like the skins of an onion. What, then, would be the book which fathers might slip to their sons, mothers to their daughters, and masters to their padawans, without ever admitting it openly? In some circles, there is a strong taboo on religion, even in circles where people go to church or read the Bible. Here, religion is one's own private business. It is bad form or uncool to talk or argue about it, and very bad indeed to make a big show of piety. Yet when you get in on the inside of almost any standard brand religion, you wonder what on earth the hush is about. Surely the book I have in mind wouldn't be the Bible, the good book, that fascinating anthology of ancient wisdom, history, and fable, which has for so long been treated as a sacred cow that it might well be locked up for a century or two so that people could hear it again with clean ears. There are indeed secrets in the Bible, and some very subversive ones, but they are also muffled up in complications, in archaic symbols and ways of thinking, that Christianity has become incredibly difficult to explain to a modern person. That is, unless you are content to water it down to being good and trying to imitate Jesus. But no one ever explains just how to do that. To do it, you must have a particular power from God, known as grace. But all that we really know about grace is that some get it and some don't. The standard brand religions, whether Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, or Buddhist, are, as now practiced, like exhausted mines, very hard to dig. With some exceptions not too easily found, their ideas about man and the world, their imagery, their rites, and their notions of the good life don't seem to fit in with the universe as we now know it, or with a human world that is changing so rapidly that much of what one learns in school is already obsolete on graduation day. The book I am thinking about would not be religious in the usual sense, but it would have to discuss many things with which religions have been concerned. The universe and man's place in it. The mysterious centre of experience which we call I myself. The problems of life and love, pain and death, and the whole question of whether existence has any meaning in any sense of the word. For there is a growing apprehension that existence is a rat race in a trap. Living organisms, including people, are merely tubes which put things in at one end and let them out at the other, which both keeps them doing it and in the long run wears them out. So to keep the fast going, the tubes keep finding ways of making new tubes, which also put things in at one end and let them out at the other. At the input end, they even develop ganglia of nerves called brains, with eyes and ears, so that they can more easily scrounge around for things to swallow. As and when they get enough to eat, they use up their surplus energy by wiggling in complicated patterns, making all sorts of noises by blowing air in and out of the input hole, and gathering together in groups to fight with other groups. In time, the tubes grow such an abundance of attached appliances that they are hardly recognisable as mere tubes, and they manage to do this in a staggering variety of forms. There is a vague rule not to eat tubes of your own form, but in general there is serious competition as to who is going to be the top type of tube. All of this seems marvellously futile, and yet when you begin to think about it, it begins to be more marvellous than futile. Indeed, it seems extremely odd. It is a special kind of enlightenment to have this feeling that the usual, the way things normally are, is odd, uncanny, and highly improbable. G.K. Chesterton once said that it is one thing to be amazed at a gorgon or a griffin, creatures which do not exist, but it is quite another and much higher thing to be amazed at a rhinoceros or a giraffe, creatures which do exist and look as if they don't. This feeling of universal oddity includes a basic and intense wondering about the sense of things. Why, of all possible worlds, this colossal and apparently unnecessary multitude of galaxies in a mysteriously curved space-time continuum, these myriads of different tube species playing frantic games of one-upmanship, these numberless ways of doing it, from the elegant architecture of the snow crystal or the diatom, to the startling magnificence of the lyrebird or the peacock. Ludwig Wittgenstein and other modern logical philosophers have often tried to suppress this question by saying that it has no meaning and ought not to be asked. Most philosophical problems are to be solved by getting rid of them, by coming to the point where you see that such questions as, why this universe, are a kind of intellectual neurosis, a misuse of words, in that the question sounds sensible, but is actually as meaningless as asking, where is the universe, when the only things that are anywhere must be somewhere inside the universe. The task of philosophy is to cure people of such nonsense. Wittgenstein, as we shall see, had a point there. Nevertheless, wonder is not a disease. Wonder, and its expression in poetry and the arts, are among the most important things which seem to distinguish people from other animals, and intelligent and sensitive people from morons. Is there then some kind of lowdown on this astounding scheme of things? Something that never really gets out through the usual channels for the answer? There is. It has been said again and again, but in such a fashion that we today, in this particular civilization, do not hear it. We do not realize that it is utterly subversive, not so much in the political and moral sense, as in that it turns our ordinary view of things, our common sense, inside out and upside down. It may, of course, have political and moral consequences, but as yet we have no clear idea of what they may be. Hitherto, this inner revolution of the mind has been confined to rather isolated individuals. It has never, to my knowledge, been widely characteristic of communities or societies. It has often been thought too dangerous for that. Hence the taboo. But the world is in an extremely dangerous situation, and serious diseases often require the risk of a dangerous cure, like the Pasteur serum for rabies. It is not that we simply blow up the planet with nuclear bombs, strangle ourselves with overpopulation, destroy our natural resources through poor conservation, or ruin the soil and its products with improper understood chemicals and pesticides. Beyond all these is the possibility that civilization may be a huge technological success, but through methods that most people will find baffling, frightening, and disorientating, because for one reason alone the methods will keep changing. It may be like playing a game in which the rules are constantly changed without ever being made clear, a game from which one cannot withdraw without suicide, and in which one can never return to an older form of the game. But the problem of people and techniques is almost always stated in the wrong way. It is said that humanity has evolved one-sidedly, growing in technical power without the comparable growth in moral integrity, or as some would prefer to say, without comparable progress in education and rational thinking. Yet the problem is more basic. The root of the matter is the way in which we feel and conceive ourselves as human beings, our sensation of being alive, of individual existence and identity. We suffer from a hallucination, from a false and distorted sensation of our own existence as living organisms. Most of us have the sensation that I, myself, is a separate centre of feeling and action, living inside and bounded by the physical body, a centre which confronts an external world of people and things, making contact through the senses with a universe both alien and strange. Everyday figures of speech reflect this illusion. I came into this world. You must face reality. The conquest of nature. This feeling of being lonely and very temporary visitors in the universe is in flat contradiction to everything known about people and all other living organisms in the sciences. We do not come into this world, we come out of it as leaves from a tree, as the ocean waves, the universe peoples. Every individual is an expression of the whole realm of nature, a unique action of the total universe. This fact is rarely, if ever, experienced by most individuals. Even those who know it to be true in theory do not sense it or feel it, but continue to be aware of themselves as isolated egos inside bags of skin. The first result of this illusion is that our attitude to the world outside us is largely hostile. We are forever conquering nature, space, mountains, deserts, bacteria, and insects, instead of learning to cooperate with them in a harmonious order. In America, the great symbols of this conquest are the bulldozer and the rocket, the instrument that batters the hills into flat tracts for little boxes made of ticky-tacky, and the great phallic projectile that blasts the sky. Nonetheless, we have fine architects who know how to fit houses into hills without ruining the landscape, and astronomers who know that the Earth is already way out in space, and that our first need for exploring other worlds is sensitive electronic instruments which, like our eyes, will bring the most distant objects into our own brains. As Fred Hoyle says, "I do not believe that anything really worthwhile will come out of the exploration of the slag heap that constitutes the surface of the moon. Nobody should imagine that the enormous financial budget of NASA implies that astronomy is now well supported." The hostile attitude of conquering nature ignores the basic interdependence of all things and events, that the world beyond the skin is actually an extension of our own bodies, and will end in destroying the very environment from which we emerge and upon which our whole life depends. The second result of feeling that we are separate minds in an alien and mostly stupid universe is that we have no common sense, no way of making sense of the world upon which we are agreed in common. It's just my opinion against yours, and therefore the most aggressive and violent, and thus insensitive, propagandist makes the decisions. A muddle of conflicting opinions, united by force of propaganda, is the worst possible source of control for a powerful technology. It might seem, then, that our need is for some genius to invent a new religion, a philosophy of life, and a view of the world that is plausible and generally acceptable for the late 20th and early 21st century, and through which every individual can feel that the world as a whole and his own life in particular have meaning. This, as history has shown repeatedly, is not enough. Religions are divisive and quarrelsome. They are a form of one-upmanship because they depend upon separating the saved from the damned, the true believers from the heretics, the in-group from the out-group. Even religious liberals play the game of "we're more tolerant than you." Furthermore, as systems of doctrine, symbolism, and behaviour, religions harden into institutions that must command loyalty, be defended, and kept pure. And all because belief is fervent hope, and thus a cover-up for doubt and uncertainty. Religions must make converts. The more people who agree with us, the less nagging insecurity about our position. In the end, one is committed to being a Christian or a Buddhist, come what may, in the form of new knowledge. New and indigestible ideas have to be wangled into the religious tradition, however inconsistent with its original doctrines, so that the believer can still take his stand and assert, "I am first and foremost a follower of Christ, Muhammad, Buddha, or whomever." Irrevocable commitment to any religion is not only intellectual suicide, it is positive unfaith, because it closes the mind to any new vision of the world. Faith is, above all, openness, an act of trust in the unknown. An ardent Jehovah's Witness once tried to convince me that if there were a God of love, he would certainly provide mankind with a reliable and infallible textbook for the guidance of conduct. I replied that no considerate God would destroy the human mind by making it so rigid and unadaptable as to depend upon one book, the Bible, for all the answers. For the use of words, and thus of a book, is to point beyond themselves to a world of life and experience that is not mere words or even ideas. Just as money is not real, consumable wealth, books are not life. To idolize scriptures is like eating paper currency. Therefore, the book that I would slip to my children would itself be slippery. It would slip them into a new domain, not of ideas alone, but of experience and feeling. It would be a temporary medicine, not a diet, a point of departure, not a perpetual point of reference. They would read it and be done with it, for if it were well and clearly written, they would not have to go back to it again and again for hidden meanings or clarification of obscure doctrine. We do not need a new religion or a new Bible. We need a new experience, a new feeling of what it is to be I. We need to develop the Jedi identity. The lowdown, which is of course the secret and profound view on life, is that our normal sensation of self is a hoax, or at best a temporary role that we are playing, or have been conned into playing, with our own tacit consent, just as every hypnotized person is basically willing to be hypnotized. The most strongly enforced of all known taboos is the taboo against knowing who or what you really are behind the mask of your apparently separate, independent, and isolated ego. I'm not thinking of Freud's barbarous id or unconscious as the actual reality behind the facade of personality. Freud, as we shall see, was under the influence of a 19th century fashion called reductionism, a curious need to put down human culture and intelligence by calling it a fluky byproduct of blind and irrational forces. They worked very hard then to prove that grapes can grow on thorn bushes. As is so often the way, what we have suppressed and overlooked is something startlingly obvious. The difficulty is that it is so obvious and basic that one can hardly find the words for it. The Germans call it a Hintergedanke, an apprehension lying tacitly in the back of our minds, which we cannot easily admit, even to ourselves. The sensation of I, as a lonely and isolated centre of being, is so powerful and commonsensical, and so fundamental to our modes of speech and thought, to our laws and social institutions, that we cannot experience selfhood except as something superficial in the scheme of the universe. I seem to be a brief light that flashes but once in all the aeons of time, a rare, complicated, and all too delicate organism on the fringe of biological evolution, where the wave of life bursts into individual, sparkling, and multicoloured drops that gleam for a moment only to vanish forever. Under such conditioning, it seems impossible and even absurd to realise that my self does not reside in the drop alone, but in the whole surge of energy which ranges from the galaxies to the nuclear fields in my body. At this level of existence, I am immeasurably old. My forms are infinite, and their comings and goings are simply the pulses or vibrations of a single and eternal flow of energy. From now on, we will call this eternal flow of energy the Force. The difficulty in recognizing the Force to be so is that conceptual thinking cannot grasp it. It is as if the eyes were trying to look at themselves directly, or as if one were trying to describe the colour of a mirror in terms of colours reflected in the mirror. Just as sight is something more than all things seen, the foundation or ground of our existence and our awareness cannot be understood in terms of things that are known. We are forced, therefore, to speak of it through myth, that is, through special metaphors, analogies, and images, which say what it is like as distinct from what it is. At one extreme of its meaning, myth is fable, falsehood, or superstition. But at another, myth is a useful and fruitful image by which we make sense of life, in somewhat the same way that we can explain electrical forces by comparing them with the behaviour of water or air. Yet myth in this second sense is not to be taken literally, just as electricity is not to be confused with air or water. Thus, in using myth, one must take care not to confuse image with fact, which would be like climbing up the signpost instead of following the road. Myth, then, is the form in which I try to answer when children ask me those fundamental metaphysical questions which come so readily to their minds. Where did the world come from? Why did God make the world? Where was I before I was born? Where do people go when they die? Again and again I have found that they seem to be satisfied with a simple and very ancient story, which goes something like this. There was never a time when the world began, because it goes round and round like a circle, and there is no place on a circle where it begins. Look at my watch, which tells the time. It goes round, and so the world repeats itself again and again. But just as the hour hand of the watch goes up to 12 and down to 6, so too there is day and night, waking and sleeping, living and dying, summer and winter. You can't have any one of these without the other, because you wouldn't be able to know what black is unless you had seen it side by side with white, or white unless side by side with black. In the same way, there are times when the world is and times when it isn't. For if the world went on and on without rest forever and ever, it would get horribly tired of itself. It comes and it goes. Now you see it, now you don't. So because it doesn't get tired of itself, it always comes back again after it disappears. It's like your breath. It goes in and out, in and out. And if you try to hold it in all the time, you feel terrible. It's also like the game of hide and seek, because it's always fun to find new ways of hiding and to seek for someone who doesn't always hide in the same place. The force also likes to play hide and seek, but because there is nothing outside the force, it has no one but itself to play with. But it gets over this difficulty by pretending that it is not itself. This is its way of hiding from itself. It pretends that it is you and I and all the people in the world, all the animals, all the plants, all the rocks, and all the stars. In this way, it has strange and wonderful adventures, some of which are terrible and frightening. But these are just like bad dreams, for when it wakes up, they will disappear. Now, when the force plays hide and pretends that it is you and I, it does it so well that it takes it a long time to remember where and how it hid itself. But that's the whole fun of it, just what it wanted to do. It doesn't want to find itself too quickly, for that would spoil the game. That is why it is so difficult for you and me to find out that we are the force in disguise, pretending not to be itself. But when the game has gone on long enough, all of us will wake up, stop pretending, and remember that we are all one single self, the force that is all there is and lives forever and ever. Of course, you must remember that the force isn't shaped like a person. People have skins, and there is always something outside our skins. If there weren't, we wouldn't know the difference between what is inside and outside our bodies. But the force has no skin and no shape, because there isn't any outside of it. With a sufficiently intelligent child, I illustrate this with a Mobius strip, a ring of paper tape twisted once in such a way that it only has one side and one edge. The inside and the outside of the force are the same. And though I have been talking about the force as an it, the force isn't even really an it. I don't like saying it, because we usually say it for things that aren't alive. The Force is alive. The Force is the self of the world, but you can't see the Force for the same reason that without a mirror you can't see your own eyes, and you certainly can't bite your own teeth or look inside your head. Yourself is that, cleverly hidden, because it is the Force hiding. You may ask why the Force sometimes hides in the form of horrible people, or pretends to be people who suffer great disease and pain. Remember, first, that it isn't really doing this to anyone but itself. Remember, too, that in almost all the stories you enjoy, there have to be bad people as well as good people, for the thrill of the tale is to find out how the good people will get the better of the bad. It's the same as when we play cards. At the beginning of the game, we shuffle them all into a mess, which is like the bad things in the world. But the point of the game is to put the mess into good order, and when one who does it best is the winner. Then we shuffle the cards once more and play again. And so it goes with the world. This story, obviously mythical in form, is not given as a scientific description of the way things are. Based on the analogies of games and the drama, and using that unfamiliar word, the Force, for the player, the story claims only to be like the way things are. I use it just as astronomers use the image of inflating a black balloon with white spots on it for the galaxies to explain the expanding universe. But to most children, and many adults, the myth is at once intelligible, simple, and fascinating. By contrast, so many other mythical explanations of the world are crude, tortuous, and unintelligible. But many people think that believing in the unintelligible propositions and symbols of their religions is the test of true faith. "I believe," said Tertullian of Christianity, "because it is absurd." People who think for themselves do not accept ideas on this kind of authority. They don't feel commanded to believe in miracles or strange doctrines, as Abraham felt commanded by God to sacrifice his son Isaac. As T. George Harris put it, "The social hierarchies of the past, where some boss above you always punished any error, conditioned men to feel a chain of harsh authority reaching all the way up there. We don't feel this bond in today's egalitarian freedom. We don't even have, since Dr. Spock, many Jehovah-like fathers in the human family. So the average unconscious no longer learns to seek forgiveness from a wrathful God above." But, he continues, "Our generation knows a cold hell, solitary confinement in this life, without a god to damn or save it, until man figures out the trap and hunts the ultimate ground of being. He has no reason at all for his existence. Empty, finite, he knows only that he will soon die. Since this life has no meaning, and he sees no future life, he is not really a person, but a victim of self-extinction." The ultimate ground of being is Paul Tillich's decontaminated term for God, and would also do for the self of the world, as I put it in my story for children. But the secret which my story slips over to the child is that the ultimate ground of being, the Force, is you. Not, of course, the everyday you, which the ground is assuming or pretending to be, but that inmost self, which escapes inspection because it's always the inspector. This, then, is the taboo of taboos. You're it. You are the Force. Yet in our culture, this is the touchstone of insanity, the blackest of blasphemies, and the wildest of delusions. This, we believe, is the ultimate in megalomania, an inflation of the ego to complete absurdity. For though we cultivate the ego with one hand, we knock it down with the other. From generation to generation, we kick the stuffing out of our children to teach them to know their place and to behave, think, and feel with proper modesty as befits one little ego among many. As my mother used to say, you're not the only pebble on the beach. Anyone in their right mind who believes that they are God should be crucified or burned at the stake. Though now we take the more charitable view that no one in his right mind could believe such nonsense. Only a poor idiot could conceive themselves as the omnipotent ruler of the world and expect everyone else to fall down and worship. But this is because we think of God as the king of the universe, the absolute technocrat, who personally and consciously controls every detail of his cosmos. And that is not the kind of God in my story. In fact, it isn't my story at all. For any student of the history of religions will know that it comes from the perennial philosophy and is the mythical way of explaining the inner truth of all religious and spiritual experience. The perennial philosophy is the basis on which all religions, through time immemorial, are based. Sophisticated theologians, and indeed the Jedi, do not think of the Force as a special and separate superperson who rules the world from above, like a monarch. The Force is underneath, rather than above, everything, and it plays the world from the inside. One might say that if religion is the opium of the people, the Jedi have the inside dope. What is more, no Jedi can realize that they are the Force in disguise without seeing it at the same time that this is true of everyone and everything else. In the perennial philosophy, nothing exists except the Force. There seem to be other things than the Force, but only because it is dreaming them up and making them its disguises to play hide and seek with itself. The universe of seemingly separate things is therefore real only for a while, not eternally real, for it comes and goes as the Force hides and seeks itself. But the perennial philosophy is much more than the idea or the belief that this is so. It is centrally and above all the experience, the immediate knowledge of it being so. And for this reason, such a complete subversion of our ordinary way of seeing things. It turns the world inside out and outside in. Likewise, a saying attributed to Jesus runs, when you make the two one, and when you make the inner as the outer, and the outer as the inner, and the above as the below, then shall you enter the kingdom. I am the light that is above them all. I am the all. The all came forth from me, and the all attained to me. Cleave a piece of wood, and I am there. Lift up the stone, and you will find me there. Today, the perennial philosophy comes down to us after centuries of involvement with all the forms, attitudes, and symbols across all religious cultures in their flowering. As often set forth, the perennial philosophy rings few bells in modern people and attracts mostly the fastidiously spiritual and diaphanous kind of people for whom incarnation in a physical body is just too disgusting to be born. But it is possible to state its essentials in a present-day idiom. And when this is done without exotic trappings, Sanskrit terminology, and excessive postures of spirituality, the message is not only clear to people with no special interest in religion, it is also the very jolt that we need to kick ourselves out of our isolated sensation of self. But this must not be confused with our usual ideas of the practice of unselfishness, which is the effort to identify with others and their needs, while still under the strong illusion of being no more than a skin-contained ego. Such unselfishness is apt to be a highly refined egotism, comparable to the in-group, which plays the game of we're more tolerant than you. The Vedanta was not originally moralistic. It did not urge people to ape the saints without sharing their real motivations, or to ape motivations without sharing the knowledge which sparks them. For this reason, the book I would pass to my children would contain no sermons, no shoulds or oughts. Genuine love comes from knowledge, not from a sense of duty or guilt. My wish would be to tell, not how things ought to be, but how they are, and how and why we ignore them as they are. You cannot teach an ego to be anything but egotistic, even though egos have the subtlest ways of pretending to be reformed. The basic thing is therefore to dispel, by experiment and experience, the illusion of oneself as a separate ego. The consequences may not be behaviour along the lines of conventional morality. It may well be as the squares said of Jesus, "Look at him, a glutton and a drinker, a friend of tax gatherers and sinners." Furthermore, on seeing through the illusion of the ego, it is impossible to think of oneself as better than or superior to others for having done so. In every direction, there is just the one self, the force, playing its myriad games of hide and seek. Birds are not better than the eggs from which they have broken. Indeed, it could be said that a bird is one egg's way of becoming other eggs. Egg is ego, and bird is the liberated self. There is a Hindu myth of the self as a divine swan, which laid the egg from which the world was hatched. Thus, I am not even saying that you ought to break out of your shell. Sometime, somehow, you, the real you, the self, the force, will do it anyhow. But it is not impossible that the play of the self will be to remain unawakened in most of its human disguises, and so bring the drama of life on earth to its close in a vast explosion. Another Hindu myth says that as time goes on, life in the world gets worse and worse, until at last the destructive aspect of the self, the god Shiva, dances a terrible dance which consumes everything in fire. There follow, says the myth, 4,320,000 years of total peace, during which the self is just itself and does not play hide. And then the game begins again, starting off as a universe of perfect splendour, which begins to deteriorate only after 1,728,000 years, and every round of the game is so designed that the forces of darkness present themselves for only one third of the time, enjoying at the end a brief but quite an illusory triumph. Today, we calculate the life of this planet alone in much vaster periods. But of all ancient civilizations, the Hindus had the most imaginative vision of cosmic time. Yet remember, this story of the cycles of the world's appearance and disappearance is myth, not science, parable rather than prophecy. It is a way of illustrating the idea that the universe is like the game of hide and seek. If, then, I am not saying that you ought to awaken from the ego illusion and help save the world from disaster, why this book? Why not sit back and let things take their course? Simply, that it is part of things taking their course that I write. As a human being, it is just my nature to enjoy and share philosophy. I do this in the same way that some birds are eagles and some doves, some flowers lilies and some roses. I realise too that the less I preach, the more likely I am to be heard.